say something about images, all images, really. The reason why I send out images in the way that I do, and the reason why I ask us to look at images, is the power of the image is that as we relate to any image, we relate obviously with our physical senses, so they impact our bodies. They also impact our imagination. They impact our feelings and our thoughts. We like the image, we dislike the image. The image produces thoughts in us and fear, and there's that interplay of thought and feeling and our own imagination that is the response to the image. But as we, if you like, as our attention unifies around the image, whether it's an inner image actually or an outer image, becomes different to us. So it becomes the focus point that then relates us into the deeper levels of the tree. Now in this particular image, the image around Mervyn, we have the sense of the egg, which is where that's holding the balance point between Gebura and Gedula. And so as we look into this image, we come into the sense of being with the green and burning tree, being with the creative these gathers. And then, but as we look into it, we come into the interplay of Gebura and Gedula, and the sense of the egg, crystal egg, being the Tiferet point. And as we go deeper into it, we come into the interplay of Mervyn, portrayed here as the ancient Mervyn with the stag horns, and the dark goddess who stands behind him and holds him. So we come into, through the gate of Dart, we come into the interplay of Hokma and Bina, and then we come into the singularity point that's deep within the goddess form of Keter. So this particular image was designed to do that very specifically. Obviously most images don't have that conscious design about them. But any image really, if it is iconic, will take us beyond the form of the image into the art, into the deconstructive place, and then takes us into that kind of mystery of the non-dual experience. Or it takes us into a self-reifying image which reflects back on us, which reinforces our own identity and closes us off. And that can happen to any image, and any it's not the image that's important really, it's the creative conversation that arises out of the contemplation of the image. The other thing that happens with all images ultimately is they become they lose their iconic potential. That's why here I change images. I spend a lot of time in this room with my images, and some of them lose their potency for me, so I stick up other ones, because actually what images are speaking to us about is this sense of the creative conversation. So Anoki Mervyn. Anoki is the return back from, so we release ourselves from being Mervyn. We may become Anoki Ganida, the sister of Mervyn, whatever our sex. This is something good that Jung talked a great deal about. If you become locked into an image and an archetypal shape, you start to lose your humanity. You start to become stereotyped. You start to develop a particular form of the heart of stone. The heart of stone sometimes can look very beautiful, but it is static and self-reifying and not capable of change.
Do you think this is the problem, or can be the problem, with well, any religion, but I was thinking of Christianity with the cross. But, you know, do you think that's where the issues come from with religion, when people...
I think it's you know, it's the problem is then that people live in a, I mean, T.S. Eliot talks about a heap of broken images in his poem The Wasteland, where he describes the modern situation where the images have lost their deeper kind of potency, their deconstructive potency, and most religions are based upon the idea of connecting with a source of goodness and life, and have normally, that's a very unusual, have an ethical dimension about people caring for each other and loving each other. And all religions, let's remember to include Buddhism in that, not just Christianity and Islam and Judaism, all religions end up with their adherents killing people who are not of that religion. And that's what happens in this process of the degradation of the images. You get into a whole complicated thing then, where people then, I think, chuck the baby out of the bathwater and reject religion, or reject religious imagery altogether. You end up with Richard Dawkins, for example, who's I don't know what I think of Richard Dawkins, really, because he just sets up strong straw man arguments all the time and doesn't engage with deeper stuff. I mean, or the other thing that you get periodically these iconoclastic movements, even within religions, that you shatter the images. It happened, you know, in the Reformation. One of the things that happened in this country is all the churches are full of beautiful painted images, and they all get smashed painted over. So you end up with these very stark white Puritan churches. And I understand the impulse of that. The impulse is that, you know, the impulse behind a Reformation is to almost to clear the field of images that have become corrupted, that have become sort of self-reifying, and certainly, you know, the medieval church, Christian church, had become this hugely corrupt, self-satisfied institution. I was listening to the radio this morning, the Anglican Communion is splitting in half at the moment because of the African churches have created the global Union of Confessing Anglicans, who are really fundamentalist Anglicans, who kind of are massively opposed to gay sexuality. It's mainly driven by the Nigerian church, but not just the Nigerian church.
They also have a problem with
a woman archbishop. And they also definitely have a problem with a woman archbishop, really. And they are seeing themselves as reformers. It's a reformation. So they are, in their minds, breaking away from the image, from the corrupted, what they believe to be the corrupted images of the church.
What amazes me is that, I'm not, deeply religious or anything, but, I'm interested, particularly more in Christianity than I've ever been, but I'm not a Christian. But, for what little I know of it, it takes me about 5 seconds to think, well, clearly Jesus wouldn't have approved of, hating gays and women.
So.
Job done. But they take hours, and they wring their hands, and they, it's like, sorry. Back and forth. So I've just done it 5 seconds. No. I'm not even the hero of Jesus.
I think Tony Pratchett says something about people
bringing
2,000 years ago, someone nailed someone up for saying we should be nice to each other.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's it.
isn't it? It's incredible.
Sorry, I don't mean to get incensed, but it's like...
It's just pathetic.
No, I think it is incensing.
I mean, it is incensing. It's just like, well, how can something so simple be so difficult? And but maybe that's what exactly what you're saying. They're so caught up in their...
It's about power. It's about, I mean, so one of the things you say, one of the things that happened, and one of the reasons why we have Christianity as an international religion is that it enables people to control people. The Emperor Constantine held a great debate, really, between somebody called Irenaeus and somebody called Valentinius. And Valentinius was a Gnostic Christian who would have said these pretty much the things you've just been saying, Bill. But Irenaeus was very much about people are sinful people, these are the rules, these are the things, and very much presented Constantine with an imperial model of a religion that would be handy in unifying his empire. And Constantine chooses Irenaeus rather than Valentinius, because Valentinius is very much looking at the sense of the inner Christ and some of these processes of the inner crucifixion as opposed to that outer process. But that's kind of no good to Constantine. It's a bit anarchic and people having lots of different views, and that's, you know, as emperor, he needs a good bureaucratic religion that is made in the image of the emperor. Because what you see happening there is the original, quite in some ways quite mystical religion of Christianity, becomes fused with the imperial cult. The Pope, some of the imagery, and even the title of the Pope, this Pontifex Maximus, the great builder of bridges. It was actually the title of the High Priest of Jupiter, who is the High Priest of the imperial cult. So what you see happening then is a fusion between the Roman imperial cult and the teachings of Jesus, and then the development really of a style of Roman Christianity, which then spreads right throughout the empire, and it is very bureaucratic. It's got a lot of rules, very handy for Rome, because Rome is this huge empire, and it needs unifying principles somewhere. Constantine himself puts out this legend of he has this image of the vision of the Christ and the vision of the cross when he's fighting against the Parthians, and he is told, in this sign shall you conquer, and so he goes on and beats up the Parthians, and okay, that's his sign that this is right. Constantine, who was a truly horrible human being who murdered most of his family, doesn't actually convert to Christianity until he's on his deathbed, because he's hedging his bets like crazy, and so this is not even a man who is a believer in the teachings of Jesus. It's clearly been very expedient, and on his deathbed he panics and sort of thinks, well, perhaps I better sign up after all, but I don't want to go to hell.
Which is that in these islands, Celtic Christianity developed so differently.
Well,
and it eventually had to line, didn't it?
Well, yeah, and that's that's partly right, and partly there are some truly horrible traditions in Celtic Christianity that are life denying. They took a lot, some of the teachings of the Desert Fathers, some of the Irish teachings about the mortification of the body and about the hatred of women, you know, so there's a whole... It's all very complicated, right, in lots of ways. But what you see happening, and I think what happens within all religions, is there's this underground stream, mystical stream, where the images become renewed, where the images become transformed, where the inner core keeps revealing itself underneath the underneath the sort of external structures. And so within, you know, within Christianity, for example, there's a whole strand of Christian mystics, many of whom are women. You have to look at somebody like Julian of Norwich, whose idea of Christ the Mother, and who, when in one of her visions, she breastfeeds. She's a child breastfeeding from the nipple of Christ. You know, who's doing different stuff with the images. Now that's the point, really, of the work of images, where they all become, it doesn't matter what images, occult images, outer images, inner images, they all end up, if you like, losing their potency, becoming idols. And then that sense of coming back to Anoki, into I am, into existence, and listening to the emergent image, which is the new icon, the new set of possibilities. So that sense of a constant sense of renewal. One of the great things, actually, about the Christian myth is that if the original story of which is the Gospel of St. Mark ends with the empty tomb. You know, the Matthew and later Gospels have Jesus being resurrected, ascending, there's a whole thing. But there's the earliest version of the Christian Gospel has Christ being crucified and dying and put in the tomb, and then Mary Magdalene, the other one, come to the tomb and it is empty, and that's where it ends. And so you're given, so it ends on a mystery, right? So the shroud is there, but he is not there. And in a way that's like the shock, right? So that's, if you're following that story, particularly if you know you're expecting a world down to the resurrection, ascension, suddenly he is not there. End of. And in a way, that's something that when you come back to some of those earlier traditions, many of whom, of course, get edited out. There's another one they edited out images, is the idea of Christ as a shapeshifter. And another early Christian idea connected to our subject is the idea of the imago Christi, the image of the Christ, the holy picture of Edessa, which is the image of the face of Christ, that is the living icon of Christ. So whoever looks at this image comes into the presence of the Christ. And that later ends up, you know, ends up in Byzantium and gets lost. That particular holy image gets lost. Edessa, ancient Edessa of itself now, is now Sanlúfar, the Turkish holy city, which is dedicated as the birthplace of Abraham. So you see weaving in these different, so if we think of some of these strange traditions, right, most people have never heard of. So at one point Christ thought of as being a shapeshifter, like Merlin. That the image of the face of Christ is a magical image, which if you look at, takes you into the present. That's the whole, in there is the whole theory behind all the Orthodox icons. There's a wonderful, I don't know if people know the Cretan writer Nikos Kazantzakis. I don't know if you've ever come across him. He's a wonderful Cretan writer who wrote powerfully about Cretan life, but also about Orthodox religion. He wrote a powerful book called The Last Temptation of Christ, which is really about, it begins with Christ on the cross, and him fantasizing, imagining a life with Mary Magdalene. And in the book, you're not sure what happened. Is he really having the, maybe he came off from the cross, maybe he survived. And right at the end, you realize that this was his last temptation. And actually, he loved Mary Magdalene, wanted to be with her, but he surrenders himself into the act of crucifixion. And so there's a whole kind of, you know, he does, if you like, the will of that deeper presence that he is devoted to. There's another great, Nikos Kazantzakis has wrote a wonderful autobiography called Report to Greco. One of the things he talks about is when he lost his virginity in an Orthodox church, surrounded by all innocent, nobody else there but him and his girlfriend, in a church, surrounded by all the icons. Now, in the Orthodox way of understanding, and his, the icons, they can see him. So he's making love in front of the saints, the prophets, the presence of Christ, the presence of the Mother. And so this is this powerfully transgressive act, because he's doing this in the middle of the living icon, affirming the power of sexuality, affirming the power of life. And in the aftermath, after they finish making love, he suddenly has this vision of Crete as the ancient goddess. And Crete is, of course, is one of the great centers in the Minoan time of the worship of the goddess. And in a way, it's a very beautiful description of the power of taking seriously the power of the living images. And in this case, reacting, you know, transgressively, but not unkindly to that. You know, in a way, it's an act of affirmation of life.
What does it mean,
transgressive? Transgressive is to do the thing that you're not supposed to do. Right? It's a, because you're at the church, you should be reverent. You're not supposed to make love in a church. You're certainly not supposed to make love in front of the holy images. You might even kind of, in fact, there's some Orthodox Christians, if they have an icon in their room and they're going to make love, they would veil the image so the image can't see them making love.
Doing it in a different way would be blasphemy, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
People just want a bit of privacy.
Yeah, you could certainly be wanting privacy, but if you don't want the Mother of God to be watching you or making love.
He doesn't feel shame.
He doesn't feel shame. No. That's the point. He doesn't feel shame, but he is in a sense committing himself to the deeper quality of life, a trust in life. And if you ever get a chance to read Zorba the Greek, which is a book full of the power and the beauty of life. Have you ever seen the film, Anthony Quinn in the film Zorba the Greek, where you have him dancing on the beach? But in the book ends with Zorba as an old man at the end of his life. And he's on his deathbed, and everybody's sitting there solemnly waiting for Zorba to die. And he suddenly brings all his energy together and leaps up and pulls himself up to a window and looks to the mountains and gives this great shout of delight at looking at the beauty of Crete and the Cretan mountains, and then falls down dead. But it's the sense what you see really with Nikos Kazantzakis. It's this deep commitment to light and life and love and energy. You know, it's a sort of and in a way that the point of the living images and the heart that is a heart of flesh, not a heart of stone, is this participation in the flow and the movement of life. And therefore, one of the things when we work with images and work with the possibility of images, we have to be very alive all the time about the way images, even beautiful images, even images that we love, lose their potency as icons. And then we have to let them go and allow the new image, the new set of possibilities to emerge. to trust, but that involves a trust in not knowing. A trust in entering into that place of anokhi. And returning really to that place of the singularity point of the beginning.
So in Islam, you don't have any images of anything involved. You have beautiful geometric patterns.
Well, how they do it is how they do it. They do it in calligraphy. They do it in. So if we look at somebody like Ibn Arabi, who was one of the great masters of the creative imagination, he does it. So how they do it is they do it in the contemplation of the names and the letters, which is also what the Kabbalah does. But also you get these beautiful poems and recitations. So the imagery doesn't apply. The way is
people being able to read.
No, they're not, because the poetry is oral in the beginning, right? What Islam does with this, and what the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, does, is to his attempt to solve this conundrum, is to break down the images, but to preserve. If you think that what the Quran is messages from Gabriel, the Archangel Gabriel, the surahs of the canal of the Quran are meant to be chanted. They're meant to be. They're expressive poems. They are statements of anokhi. And so that tradition comes right into Islam. Where Islam is full of images, but they're not painted images, except in Persia. In Persia, you have this powerful kind of traditions of Persian art. You have these wonderful Persian miniatures. You have the teachings of Zoroaster, and the Hura Mazda, and the conflict in Hura Mazda and the Ahriman. So there you have And out of Persia, you get a Sufism that is called the traditions of Shawadi, the traditions of light. So, in a certain sense, and you see, this is true of things like the Protestant reformers. And so, what do the Protestant reformers do in Britain? They break down all the external images. They make the Bible available to everybody. They read out parts of the Bible, which generate whole screeds of images. So the image really is unavoidable. Now, in our time, one of the things that's happened to the image is it's become a handy way to sell things. Such as the state of our civilization, that actually, we've worked out, okay. If we implant the right kind of image in somebody, which is an image basically that says, I am incomplete unless I buy this. And behind each image, and certainly behind adverts, is a whole worldview, a Weltanschauung, really, that is intended to bring us into that. Get us buying whatever it is they're selling, but also it's more subtle than that we absorb an attitude and an approach to life, which makes us the passive consumers of what is needing to be sold. I mean, this advertising has got very, very sophisticated. I always like to think of the washing. The washing powder adverts from the when I was a kid, where these ecstatic women waving, whiter than white, does makes you whiter than white, people are skipping around on the screen, whiter than white, and even that's an extraordinary. What is whiter than white? Superlatives there, it's a seductive superlative designed to thinking that nothing else can do this but this. And that is the function of the idol. I serve the idol. The idol is the form that nothing else. Okay, so the idol connects me to the source of life in a peculiar kind of way. Or it pretends to connect me to the source of life in a peculiar way. The idol always is bigger than us. It has it's not alive in its form, it's stone-like. But it contains within itself a certain way of thinking, feeling and doing, and offers the illusion of substantiality. The icon offers true substantiality, but requires us to lay down our forms, to enter back into the mystery of Anokhi. And what we see coming back to Mervyn, we need to break for lunch now, but I'll come back to this after lunch. What you see happening to Mervyn, you see this very early image of the man from the sea. We see the protean figure. We see then we get these flashes of poems of this guy a wounded warrior or a wounded king wandering in a wood talking to his pig and bemoaning his life and lost in the wood. And then this image gets more formed. And we encountered the child Merlin yesterday when we were looking at the Vortigern and the prophecies of Merlin. So we get this image really of this child prophet who can see right to the end of time. And what we're going to see shortly when we look at the history of Merlin after lunch is a different image of Merlin. Merlin is that more mature human being, but who is lost in the middle of his life. Right, who has been in a terrible battle and is trying to make sense of the awfulness of life. It's a very similar beginning to the beginning of Dante's Divine Comedy. Dante's Divine Comedy with Dante saying, "I'm lost in a dark wood, in the middle of my life." And there's a leopard stalking me, and I don't know where to go, and he has the guidance of, and it's an extraordinary book, The Divine Comedy. If you've not read it, it's not an easy book, I recommend it. It's got a very powerful system of Kabbalistic psychology in it, because you begin in Malchut with Dante, lost in the confusions of Yesod and Hod and Netzach and in the tangle of the woods. And Virgil comes to him. Now Virgil in the time that Dante was writing is a Merlin figure. He's an architect, he's a magician. And Virgil represents the silent voice of Tiferet. And so Virgil, as his companion, leads him down into the kingdoms of the Klipot, leads him into the confusions. So when I was talking yesterday about bringing Anokhi into the places that are lost, into the rage, into the fear, this Dante is graphically describing this as he descends through the seven levels of hell. And where he takes us to at the deepest level, the ninth level, nine levels rather, when we come to the ninth level of hell, we come to the figure of the figure of Satan, who is this ice block, icy, rigidified, stony kind of figure, who is the literal incarnation of the heart of stone. And what happens is that Virgil takes him right through all of that. And as he moves him through that, he then takes him to a mountain called the Mountain of Purgation, the Mountain of Purification. And there he's met and then Virgil surrenders him into the hands of into the glorified Beatrice, who represents Bina, who represents the higher soul. And Beatrice guides him through the spheres of purification, and he moves to various of the he's moving through the medieval cosmos, really. So he's reached the center of the earth, and he comes then through the seven spheres until he comes to the Imperium, which is the place beyond the stars, in the stars, which is envisaged as a vast white rose. And Beatrice, as Bina, brings him into this place. And then she passes him on to Saint Bonaventure, who is a kind of Hokmah figure, who takes him into the dynamics of the white rose. And what you find at the heart of the white rose is three rings representing the Trinity, the three principles of life. And the singularity point, the single point, is right at the heart. The Anoki point is right at the heart of the three rings. So there's a way of reading the Dante's Divine Comedy as a description of Kabbalistic psychology. It's also full of Florentine politics that he was chucked out. So one of the things he does, which is, if you know the history of it, it's kind of quite fun, for the likes of me as well, but where he puts he sticks all his enemies into various circles of hell, and has demons sticking red hot pokers up their backsides and things, and has them upside down in filth and kind of, and he's writing it in Ravenna. Where if you go to Ravenna, you can find the tomb of Dante. It has a very beautiful tomb with an ever-burning light upon it, really. And in a way, Dante is one of the great exemplars of working with the way of images, because he gives us all the images of despair, all the images of darkness. He gives us the images of purification, and then he gives us this extraordinary image of the white rose, each petal of which is a living soul connected to the mystery of the three rings and the single point. So he takes us into that, takes us out of confusion. He takes us out of being lost in the wood. He takes us into all the idols of our nature. He takes us right into relationship with the energy of a heart of stone itself. And then Beatrice takes us through a process of transformation and the freeing of ourselves from that seeming solidity into a fluidity. So we discover our nature as beings of light, and then we find our place then within the white rose, and we find our relationship with the Anoki point. That is the center of our being. So that's that, really.
I thought it was really significant that the folks in America are called ice.
Yeah.